Good day. Today is Thursday, 6th November 2025. And before I proceed with the rest of the video, please let me remind you once again to tick the like button if once you've watched and listened to the video or that part of the video that you want to listen and watch, you've liked what you've heard and you wanted to indicate that fact. Well, with that, let me proceed with the substance, the matters under discussion in this video. And let me start with another very important, very interesting meeting, which took place yesterday in Moscow in the Russian Security Council. Now, this meeting took place in the Kremlin, in the Senate chamber, and it was a meeting in which Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, chaired the Security Council, which, as I've discussed in many programs, is Russia's most important policy-making body. It is the committee which ultimately governs Russia. Putin chairs it. In theory, the meeting is consultative. The purpose of this committee is consultative. But in practice, Putin tends to defer to the consensus that the committee, the Security Council, forms. And this was a very high-powered meeting indeed, as shown by the list of people who attended. All the big heavy hitters in the Russian political world were there, apart from the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, whose absence is unexplained, but I doubt of any great significance. Maybe he's unwell, maybe he's busy doing something somewhere. Anyway, he was not at the meeting, but nobody should draw any conclusions from that. Everyone else who matters in Russia, in the political system, in the decision-making core of the government was there. Putin was there, Medvedev was there, Belousov, the defense minister, was there, Mishustin, the prime minister, was there, the intelligence chiefs, Bortnikov and Naryshkin, were there, Sergei Ivanov, a very powerful figure, formerly in Russian politics, somebody who at one time was widely expected to succeed Putin as president, but who in the event didn't do so, and who holds no very clear-cut role in Russian affairs today, but who remains an important and powerful figure behind the scenes. He too was there. The people in charge of internal security, the National Guard and the FSB, they too were there. Shoigu, the Secretary of the Security Council, the former Defence Minister, he too was there, as was Gerasimov, the Chief of the General Staff. Gerasimov, incidentally, is not a full member of the Security Council. He has what is called alternative or candidate membership, a rank carried over from the former Soviet Politburo. The Soviet Politburo had full members who were able to attend every meeting and to vote in them, and what were called candidate members, officials who attended meetings and might participate in the meetings, but would not be given the actual right to vote. Gerasimov is a candidate member, and he's a candidate member ex officio, because that is the status, a status automatically granted to the Chief of the General Staff. As we shall see, Gerasimov himself attended this meeting. So they're all there, and Putin introduced the meeting, and he said that, as you are aware, our government delegation has just returned from a trip to the People's Republic of China. I've discussed this trip in various recent programs. The government delegation led by Prime Minister Mishustin, which met with the Chinese Prime Minister Li Qiang, and which had an important and high-level meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Anyway, Putin mentions this. He then says that Mr. Mishustin briefed me in detail about the results of this work. I believe it was a very timely, substantive, and useful. After we are done reviewing the main issues, I would like Mr. Mishustin to brief all our colleagues on the outcomes of his travel to China. Transport security is our main issue today. The speaker is Transport Minister Andrei Nikitin. And then the moment after Putin says that, one of the attendees, Vyacheslav Volodin, the Speaker of the Russian Parliament, the Duma, cuts in. Mr. President, I have an off-the-agenda question. May I? And Putin says, yes, please. And then the question comes from Volodin. He says, considering that Trump, notice just Trump, not President Trump or Donald Trump, he's now just Trump in Russian political discourse. Considering that Trump recently stated that the United States was resuming nuclear weapons testing, the deputies, in other words, the MPs of the Russian parliament, have questions and are concerned about the situation overall, because this could push the world we all know where. He means, by the way, into an all-out nuclear arms race. Since you made it clear, this is a question to Putin, since you made it clear 2 years ago that if the United States was to resume nuclear weapons testing, Russia would be entitled to do the same, could you provide more clarity on this issue, which virtually every deputy is concerned about? They would like to know what kind of steps and actions we are going to take, since this is an extremely important matter, all the more so as the US president has brought it up. And then Putin says, indeed, this is a serious matter. Let's hear what our colleagues have to say about it. And then he calls on Defense Minister Belousov to take the floor. Now, I have to say, this is extremely unusual. I'm not going to say it is completely unprecedented. I'm not going to claim that I've read every single report of Russian Security Council meetings. But for a member of the Security Council to basically cut in after Putin has started to speak and to say to him, well, hold on, we all understand that transport security does matter, but we have actually much more important things to discuss, nuclear weapons testing being specifically the issue, and that the entire Russian parliament is very worried about this. Well, this is extremely unusual, and, well, I cannot remember ever seeing anything quite like that happen before. And of course, Putin, we are supposed to assume, meekly goes along with this. He says, well, you know, you're absolutely right. This is indeed a serious matter, very serious matter. So let's, in fact, discuss it. Let's put the rest of the issues that form our agenda to one side, and let's instead talk about the topic of nuclear testing, which is worrying people in the parliament and which you have brought up in this way. Now, I'm going to say straight away that I think this whole thing was staged. I said that all of the important people were there, all of the military, the security people, the intelligence people, they're all there. And they are obviously there because they know that there is going to be a discussion about this issue of nuclear weapons testing. And what I think we have just seen is a carefully choreographed way for the Russians to bring up this topic. The Russian Security Council wasn't convened to discuss the question of nuclear weapons testing, because that might have led to the view that the Russians assumed that the United States is about to embark upon nuclear weapons testing, in which case the Security Council would have had to make a decision about it. As we will see, they actually deferred a decision. But at the same time, they wanted to make clear both to the Russian public and the Russian military and the Russian security services, but perhaps first and foremost to the United States, that these words, these wild, unexplained words by President Trump about the United States recommencing nuclear testing, are being taken very seriously in Russia, and to give a warning to the Americans that if the Americans do intend to proceed in this way, then Russia will respond, and will respond in a way that essentially will bury once and for all any possibility of détente being achieved between Russia and the United States in the foreseeable future. And that, I think, is why the meeting was arranged in this way. Now, what then happens is that we then have an extraordinary procession of speakers, and it's all the top people in the Russian defense and security system. So in order of speakers, it's Belousov, the defense minister, Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff, Naryshkin, the head of Russian foreign intelligence, the SVR, Shoigu, the secretary of the Security Council, who was previously defense minister, Bortnikov, the head of the FSB, the counterintelligence agency, and as I said, one after the other, they then give their views. And they discuss over the course of this conversation, in which Putin himself actively participates, this entire conversation, by the way, being televised and broadcast to the Russian people, and of which we have been provided with this, a long transcript by the Kremlin itself. Anyway, they then discuss Donald Trump's words about the United States resuming nuclear testing. And there is a general agreement that nobody in the Russian leadership can understand exactly what Donald Trump was talking about. They all say to each other, well, Donald Trump, remember, this is all conducted in public. Donald Trump says all sorts of extraordinary things. Maybe he means it, maybe he doesn't. Nobody is quite sure. But the military, Belousov, Shoigu and Gerasimov, all say the same thing. We have to take this seriously. The President of the United States, after all, has spoken. There is, therefore, a real possibility, or we must assume that there is a real possibility, that the United States is indeed going to resume nuclear testing. In effect, going back on the various test ban agreements that the Soviet Union and then Russia and the United States and other nuclear powers have come to with each other. And perhaps the most important speaker here is Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff, and he says this: the absence of an official explanation from the American side regarding President Trump's statement on resuming nuclear testing offers no assurance that the United States will not soon begin preparing for and then conduct nuclear tests. Now, what Gerasimov is referring to here is that the Russian foreign ministry, after Trump made his statement about the United States resuming nuclear testing, as it turns out, and as we learn from this meeting, the Russian foreign ministry instructed the Russian ambassador to conduct the various relevant agencies in the US government, the Department of Energy, the State Department, and others, asking them, can you please explain to us what Donald Trump actually meant? Are you really intending to resume nuclear testing or not? And the word that came back from the Russian ambassador to Moscow is that none of the officials, the American officials who were contacted, came back with any kind of coherent answer. All of them said that they were not really able to comment, that they were going to pass on the Russian concerns up the command chain, presumably to the president himself, but they were not able to say that the United States is indeed going to abide by its current policy of not engaging in nuclear testing, or alternatively, that it would go back on this policy and actually resume nuclear testing. So Gerasimov says we are given this extraordinary situation. Given this extraordinary situation, we have no assurance that the United States will not soon begin preparing for and then conduct nuclear tests. And then he says this: the American side may continue to evade providing official explanations, but this is immaterial. If we do not take appropriate measures now, we will lose the ability to respond in a timely manner to US actions, given that preparing for nuclear tests, depending on their type, can take anywhere from several months to several years. We are aware of statements by a number of high-ranking US officials regarding the resumption of nuclear tests, and our analysis of these statements indicates Washington's intent to prepare for and conduct such tests. So Gerasimov says that the opinion of the military, the Russian military, as you might expect, is that the Americans almost certainly are going to go ahead and resume nuclear testing. And he is telling Putin that given that this is so, there is no time to waste. We must get ourselves organized as well. If the Americans start testing, then so must we. And given that it's likely that the Americans are beginning preparations now, we must do so also. And, well, the discussion then continues. There's, as I said, uncertainty. We learn from Naryshkin, the intelligence chief, that, as I said, the Russians requested clarifications from the National Security Council and the State Department. Representatives from both the White House and the US Department of State declined to provide a substantive reaction, assuring that they would relay the information up the chain and contact the Russian side if it were deemed necessary to provide explanations. So you can imagine that the Russians are not going to be pleased with all of that. Anyway, after a long discussion in which everybody agrees that this is a very serious issue and a very serious problem, the only person who expresses some uncertainty is Bortnikov, the head of the FSB, who says that he has not yet got enough information to express a view, and he needs more time in order to delve deeper into the matter and draft proposals. Anyway, Putin then comes back and says this: I took note of some of your remarks and opinions, and I would like to note that Russia has always strictly adhered to its obligations under the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, and we do not intend to abandon these obligations. At the same time, indeed, in my 2023 address to the Federal Assembly, I said that if the United States or any other state party to the treaty was to conduct such tests, Russia would be under obligation to take reciprocal measures. In this regard, I instruct the Foreign Ministry, the Defence Ministry, the Special Services and the corresponding civilian agencies to do everything possible to gather additional information on the matter, have it analysed by the Security Council, and submit coordinated proposals on the possible first steps focusing on preparations for nuclear weapons tests. So there it is. Russia is now taking note of what President Trump has said, of what other US officials have said about this matter, and they are now undertaking their own preparations to resume nuclear weapons tests. Now, I cannot express sufficiently strongly how dismayed I am by this whole situation and the utterly reckless, indeed heedless way in which we seem to be hurtling forward to what I fear could turn out to be a major disaster. I've already spoken many times about the total collapse of the arms control, the nuclear arms control regime, which was laboriously negotiated and agreed in the 1960s and 1970s and 1980s by the Soviet Union and the United States. Only one arms limitation treaty remains in force. That is the New START treaty, and it is about to expire in February. And there is no sign that the Americans are interested in taking up the Russian proposal to extend that treaty for 1 year in order to negotiate its potential replacement. So all the indications are that this treaty is going to expire in just 4 months' time, meaning that at that point, there will be no arms limitation treaties of any importance left. The President of the United States has just made comments which have been seized upon by certain officials in the United States, which, whether intentionally or not, are creating a further tremor in the system, so that it is entirely possible now that we're going to be drifting back into a situation when the superpowers, the United States and Russia, resume nuclear testing, nuclear weapons testing. If the Americans and the Russians do that, of course the Chinese, the Indians, the Pakistanis, the North Koreans, all of them are going to follow. We will be back in a world where there is regular testing of nuclear weapons. This at a time when there is no arms control regime to speak of, and when tensions between the superpowers have risen to astonishing levels. And what this meeting was about, what its purpose was, in my opinion, was to warn the Americans, to try to get the Americans to understand this, to try to get the Americans to understand that if they go down this fatal road, Russia will have no choice but to begin nuclear testing itself, and that we will indeed, in that case, be in an unrestrained, uncontrolled nuclear arms race. Now, I cannot understand why the United States is not heeding these warnings. My colleague and friend, Alex Cristoforo, has suggested in programs that we did on the Duran, we've done together on the Duran, that President Trump is perhaps being influenced by advisors who are telling him that he should mimic what President Reagan supposedly did in the 1980s, which is engage the Soviet Union in an unrestrained nuclear arms race, both on the ground and in space, and that the Soviet Union, overwhelmed by the cost of keeping up with the United States in this arms race, essentially pulled up the white flag and capitulated to the United States, thereby ending the Cold War. Now, I know that this is a very widely believed version of history in the United States. It is neocon dogma, if I may say. If you go to places like National Review, for example, they take it as absolute gospel truth that this was exactly what happened. It bears absolutely no relation to the reality of that time, which I lived through and remember well. US officials who participated in the negotiations and the discussions between the United States and the Soviet Union at that time, people like Ambassadors Jack Matlock and Chas Freeman, and Ronald Reagan's economic advisor, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, people, in other words, who knew Reagan and worked with him at that very time, all deny that this was ever Reagan's intention and that he was ever working along this extraordinarily reckless and unwise and dangerous path. Besides which, what many people perhaps don't understand is that the extraordinary arms build-up that the United States did engage in the 1980s did not in any material way affect the balance of power, the military balance between the superpowers. Before the Reagan build-up, the Soviet Union was outproducing the United States in nuclear warheads. It continued to do so during the time of Reagan's presidency. And, well, it went on doing so, as I remember, into the time of George H.W. Bush. And as for President Reagan's strategic defense initiative, that basically collapsed well before negotiations, serious negotiations on strategic arms ever really began to take shape. So this is a false history. It is a narrative that many people have, but it bears no connection to reality. Well, sometimes people do make decisions based on wrong history, and it doesn't really matter very much. But this time, I'm afraid it will. Because quite apart from anything, the world of today is profoundly different from the world of the 1980s. In the 1980s, there were two global military nuclear superpowers, the Soviet Union and the United States. Now there are three. In the 1980s, American manufacturing was the greatest in the world, though in heavy industry and military production, the Soviet Union could generally match it. Today, the United States is unable to compete in manufacturing against its rivals, China and Russia. China alone has a significantly bigger manufacturing base than the United States, and the gap, by the way, is growing. China and Russia are de facto allies, and in combination, they can exceed any military buildup that the United States engages in. In fact, in my opinion, it wouldn't even be close. So what is being attempted here? A nuclear arms race at this time is going to disadvantage the United States. It's going to increase pressures. It is the United States that is clocking up debt, that is running deficits, both in its budget and in its external trade. It is the United States that has just gone through 8 consecutive months of industrial decline. What is the leadership of the United States thinking when it embarks on these plans? And is it paying any attention to what the Russians, the Chinese before long, others are going to be saying? Well, to say it straightforwardly and frankly, I don't think the United States is listening. I suspect that this meeting that took place in Moscow is one that the government, the officials in the United States are going to pay no attention to. The days when there were people like Ray McGovern working away in the US intelligence community, following very carefully, tracking very carefully what was being said by senior officials in Moscow and Beijing and communicating them to the American leadership and explaining their meaning, all those days, unfortunately, are gone. I strongly suspect that Donald Trump's words about nuclear testing were never really thought through. They were an impulsive, jealous reaction to the fact that the Russians had just successfully tested the Burevestnik nuclear-powered cruise missile, of which the United States has no analog, and probably out of a sense of injured vanity, the president felt that he had to somehow redress the balance, which seemed to be shifting in favor of Russia in terms of nuclear weapons and strategic weapons, by saying that the United States should consider strategic a resumption of nuclear testing. And unfortunately, what inevitably happens in Washington is that when anyone in authority, and there is no higher authority in the US system than the president himself, appears to take a hard line, other officials who are hardliners themselves immediately jump in and act to reinforce it. So I have been dismayed to see over the last couple of days reports circulating mostly on social media, but which are clearly sourced from the CIA, that the CIA has advised the president that the Russians have conducted covert nuclear testing in some form and that they are already in breach of their obligations, and therefore it is correct and wise for the United States to resume nuclear testing itself. OK, Can I say right away that that claim is ridiculous? It is impossible to conceal a nuclear weapons test. I've obtained advice about this, and I have no doubt that this is true. Moreover, if the United States had reason to think that the Russians had indeed covertly resumed nuclear testing, they would undoubtedly have said so publicly, and they would undoubtedly have complained about it to the Russians. And there is no doubt, no evidence that they have done any such thing. So probably an off-the-cuff remark by the President of the United States is now being seized on by all the usual people in Washington, and they are moving us further and further back into the kind of uncontrolled nuclear arms race that we used to have during the Cold War, the enormous perils of which I clearly remember. Well, that's what I'm going to say about this from the nuclear weapons perspective. But let me say something further at this point. Now, ever since President Trump was inaugurated President of the United States, and perhaps before, there has been an attempt by the Americans and the Russians, by Trump and Putin, to find some way back in terms of restoring US-Russia relations. I think this whole journey has unfortunately been filled with misunderstandings and an inability in Washington to understand the Russian position or to accept that with respect to Ukraine, the Russians mean what they say. Again, we see the problem caused by the absence of people like Ray McGovern providing the advice to the heads of the intelligence community and to the President of the United States that we used to see during the Cold War. But anyway, an attempt, however poorly thought out, to restore relations does seem to have taken place. And I've already discussed in several programmes, in many programmes now, how over the last couple of weeks, as this process has led nowhere, as Trump has walked back agreements that he appeared to have himself initiated and which seemed to have been, from a Russian point of view, all but finalised in Alaska, how that process has deteriorated, embarrassing Putin himself, opening him up to criticism within the Russian leadership, and causing a significant hardening of the Russian response. What this meeting in Moscow now shows is that Russian trust in the Trump administration has completely collapsed, not just in the administration, but in the president himself. They clearly all believe that the only safe thing to do from now on is to assume the worst from anything that he says. And, well, the whole question, the whole issue, prospect of future US-Russian relations, now it seems to me, hangs by a thread. We should not make the mistake of thinking that if the US and Russia move forward with it, are catapulted into a nuclear arms race, that will be as easy to bring under control as was the case in the 1960s and the 1970s. Actually, I take that back. It wasn't easy in the 1960s or 70s at all, but at least it was possible. It might not be possible in the same way this time because of the Chinese, the North Koreans, the Pakistanis, the Indians, who knows whom else. This time, there are so many actors that it might become impossibly complicated. All of these other actors are certain to respond themselves. And how do you re-establish an arms control regime and the trust between the great powers that comes with it in a situation like that? We're going to be much closer to the world that existed pre-1914, when the great powers of Europe were busy rearming and trust between them was fading and they were all becoming increasingly fearful of each other and unwilling to consider compromises. We are going to be much closer to that world than we ever were at any point during the Cold War. Anyway, there it is. That's what I want to say about this. This is an extremely important meeting in Moscow. I suspect that its importance in Washington will be completely underestimated. And I noticed that across the media in London, it has been barely reported at all. Anyway, let's now discuss other things and let's return to the perennial topic of these programs, which is the conflict in Ukraine. Now, over the last couple of hours, the Russian Defense Ministry has again provided us with updates about the situation in Kupiansk and in Pokrovsk, and these continue to imply a continuing deterioration of the position of the Ukrainian forces in these two places. So starting with Kupiansk, the Russian Defense Ministry says this: assault detachments of the 6th Army continue to destroy the encircled enemy group close to Kupiansk. Three attacks of the 144th Mechanized Brigade, the 92nd Assault Brigade of the Ukrainian Army and the 15th National Guard Brigade to unblock the encircled formations were repelled near Nechvolodovka and Blagodatovka in Kharkov region. The attempt of a group of servicemen of the 116th Mechanized Brigade of the Ukrainian Army to break out of the encirclement in a western direction has been thwarted. A breakthrough of an enemy assault group to the destroyed Oskol River crossing for its restoration was thwarted close to Petrovka. And then the Defense Ministry gives us his usual account of the numbers of Ukrainian troops who it says were, as it puts it, neutralized, presumably killed, captured or severely wounded. And it says that the total in the area of the Kupiansk cauldron was 215. The key point is that the Russian Defense Ministry continues to insist against Zelensky's claims that the Kupiansk cauldron continues and continues to tighten. And the Russian Defense Ministry has also provided information about the situation in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. And in my opinion, the information it's provided is dramatic. In Pokrovsk, assault groups of the Second Army continue to eliminate the encircled Ukrainian formations in the eastern part of the central district and in the western part of the industrial area, as well as to mop up settlements of Gnatovka and Rog. In the past 24 hours, 64 buildings have been liberated. 64 buildings. That suggests strongly to me an accelerating collapse. Previously, we've had reports of a dozen, 17, two dozen buildings. Suddenly, notice the jump, 64 buildings. It looks to me as if the Ukrainian troops continue to pull back and retreat from their positions within the Pokrovsk cauldron. Then the Russian defense ministry continues. Russian troops repelled 13 enemy attacks in order to unblock the Ukrainian encircled formations in the area of Grishino. In addition, three attempts of the 425th Assault Regiment, assault regiments units of the Ukrainian military to break through the encirclement ring in a northern direction have been thwarted. Now, there's been a lot of confusion about the 425th Assault Regiment. I believe this is the same as the Skala Regiment, but if I'm wrong about that, apologies. There are some opinions that the Russians here are discussing attempts by this unit to break in to the Pokrovsk cauldron, in other words, to unblock the Ukrainian forces in the Pokrovsk cauldron. My own clear reading of what the Defense Ministry is saying is that this special force, these special forces troops, are trying to break out and that they are failing to do so. Now, this perhaps explains a video which the Ukrainians have recently published within the last few hours, which purports to show Ukrainian troops in various parts of Pokrovsk waving Ukrainian flags. I believe that that video was published by this particular unit. I may be wrong here, but I believe that it is. And I suspect that that part of the video, which is contemporaneous with the events, there are some claims that some parts of this video are a rehashed version of earlier footage made earlier in the battle. I'm not going to comment about this. I can't understand. I mean, making sense of footage in that way is very difficult for me. But anyway, I suspect that some of this footage, the footage that really was taken yesterday, if it really was taken yesterday, is connected again with this particular breakout attempt. The Ukrainian troops, in other words, are flying the Ukrainian flags basically to indicate to the Ukrainian, to the Ukrainians where they were and to try to get assistance to them as they themselves made various attempts to break out. That, it seems to me, is what the Russian Defense Ministry is saying. And it seems to me that it's most consistent with what we see of the footage. Now, I should say that this video film has been much commented upon by Ukrainian commentators. Again, the invaluable Substack blog, Events in Ukraine, has done a compilation. And the comments by the Ukrainian bloggers about this video are cumulatively scathing. They regard all the flag waving as a reckless, annoying stunt, which is clearly being published in order to distract attention from the appalling quality of the crisis on the ground. And by the way, with that view, I absolutely agree. Anyway, the point is, the Russian Defense Ministry are saying that the encirclement continues, and they are claiming that a significant portion of the area of the cauldron has indeed fallen under Russian control. And the Russians again also talk about the situation in Mirnograd. In Mirnograd, units of the 5th Motorized Rifle Brigade continue active offensive in the direction of the Zapadny micro district. 19 buildings have been liberated from the Ukrainian troops. Over the past 24 hours, more than 220 Ukrainian troops and various items of equipment have been neutralized near Pokrovsk and Dmitrov. And more than 480 troops have been neutralized in the area of group of centers, Russian group of centers area of responsibility. Now, this is consistent again with most of the video footage we are getting. There is no doubt that there are Ukrainian troops in various parts of Pokrovsk, but there is no doubt also that they are trapped. There are no exit points. There have been many reports about a Ukrainian counterattack north of Pokrovsk, again in the area of the Russian breakthrough. This remains General Sirski's obsession. He continues to throw unit after Ukrainian unit into this area, trying to roll back the Russian offensive, breakthrough area, breakthrough positions close to Dobropilia. Zelensky himself, as I discussed in my program yesterday, recently visited Dobropilia himself, where he appears to have urged the commanders, the Ukrainian commanders, to give everything they have to this counterattack in the area of the Russian breakthrough. There is actually minimal video footage of Ukrainian gains, and Radovka, the Russian newspaper, which, as I said, has been consistently the most reliable reporter of the Battle of Pokrovsk, says that the major Ukrainian counterattacks, especially those towards Rodinska, have all been repelled and have been unsuccessful. There were reports circulating in the media yesterday, the Ukrainian media space yesterday, that a political military decision has been taken by the Ukrainian leadership, that Pokrovsk supposedly must be held at all costs, that the fall of Pokrovsk will open the way for a Russian advance towards the Dnieper. I've discussed in many places, extending all the way back to 2022, how if the Russians were to reach the Dnieper in central Ukraine, it would be a mortal blow for Ukraine. It would essentially destroy Ukraine's remaining viability as a state, certainly within its current borders. And apparently, this is the view of the Zelensky government. And so Zelensky is giving Sirski, and Sirski in turn is giving the Ukrainian commanders orders that whatever happens, there will be no surrender of Pokrovsk. The soldiers in Pokrovsk and in Mirnograd must go on resisting, presumably to the last bullet and to the last man. And in the meantime, the Ukrainian authorities will throw everything they've got, every spare unit that they can find, to try to break through, to to break the siege and to rescue the men inside Pokrovsk. And there are reports, by the way, that further, more Ukrainian military units are being pulled from various areas of the front lines to try to stabilize the situation in Pokrovsk, to try to break through the ring, to rescue the men inside Pokrovsk, to break the Russian encirclement, to hold on to Pokrovsk at all costs. And I've seen reports that Ukrainian troops have been withdrawn from Sumy region, enabling the Russians to go back on the offensive there. From Kharkiv region, where the Russians are now operating well to the south of the town of Volchansk, of which apparently there's only one small area in the east that the Russians still have to capture. Of the Ukrainians pulling troops out of Kherson region on the west bank of the Dnieper River. That, I would have thought, was a particularly dangerous thing to do, given that there are lots of reports that the Russians now have established at least some sort of presence on the west bank of the Dnieper River and might have a presence in some of the southern suburbs of the city of Kherson. But anyway, that everything that there is and which can be spared is now being thrown into the battle, basically to try to save Pokrovsk. Now, again, perhaps the best comment about all of this comes from the Ukrainian blogging sites themselves. You can find them all. Again, you can find a compilation in Events in Ukraine, this Substack blog. But what they all say is that it's all far too late. Pokrovsk has, to all intents and purposes, already fallen. The Ukrainians are throwing men, of which they have a short supply, and machines, of which they have an even shorter supply, to try to hold on to a town that is already effectively lost. Yes, there are some Ukrainian troops still in isolated pockets in various parts of Pokrovsk. There are still some Ukrainian troops forming a more organized resistance in eastern Pokrovsk. There are Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd as well. But the Russians have the place encircled. Their drones dominate the skies. Their artillery and their air force is active. There is no hope now of breaking the encirclement or of holding Pokrovsk. And trying to do so is going to deplete Ukrainian reserves to a critical point at what is already a critical point in the war. Now, I would add to this that probably this is what the Russians would want the Ukrainians at this moment in time to do. The Russians continue to say that Pokrovsk is encircled. And I think most people who have been following the battle closely, about everybody who follows the battle closely, would agree with this. From a Russian point of view, having the remaining Ukrainian reserves burn themselves on the fields north of Pokrovsk in some quixotic quest to try to recapture the town or to hold the town works exactly to Russian advantage. Now, this has perhaps finally been grasped by some of Ukraine's friends in the United States as well. The Washington Post, which is a newspaper which has always struck me as being particularly close to the American intelligence community, has published now a lengthy article which also calls into question this entire policy of trying to hold on to Pokrovsk. And it's an interesting article because it says that as Pokrovsk is set to fall, the obvious and correct thing for the Ukrainians to do is to withdraw, that there is really no point in holding on, that saving the men who are defending Pokrovsk is now the only thing that really matters. And as one might expect, the Washington Post also tries to downplay the significance of the fall of Pokrovsk. It says that it would be a propaganda victory for the Russians. That's its main significance, apparently. Though it does also concede that if Pokrovsk were to fall, that would indeed open the way for the Russians to advance to the Dnieper. Anyway, the Washington Post advises that Ukraine withdraw from Pokrovsk. Now, a couple of days ago, I think 2 days ago, the US ambassador to NATO, Matthew Whitaker, also went to Kiev and met with Zelensky there. And I've already discussed this visit in my previous program. And I floated the possibility that, again, Whitaker went there to try to get Zelensky to be a little bit more realistic about the realities of the war and to see whether Zelensky might now finally understand that Donbass is indeed lost and might start taking steps in that direction, in which case that might make it easier for Donald Trump to return to the understandings that he reached with Putin in Alaska, whereby the Ukrainians withdraw from Donbass and the Russians stop their advance in Zaporozhye and Kherson region. I wonder whether Whitaker also came with a message to Zelensky that the time has come to accept that Pokrovsk is lost and to pull out of Pokrovsk. I noticed that the article, the Washington Post article, appears to acknowledge that the Ukrainian grouping in Pokrovsk is effectively encircled and admits that a withdrawal from Pokrovsk now would be extremely difficult. But anyway, nonetheless, I get the sense that that is what the Americans are advising Zelensky to do. In which case, these reports coming from Kiev that Ukraine is not prepared to pull out of Pokrovsk are Zelensky's response to the Americans, as much as they are an expression of Zelensky's determination to hold on to every millimetre of Ukrainian territory wherever he can. So there it is. A debacle, an enormous disaster for the Ukrainian army is coming. I don't just mean now the fall of Pokrovsk. As I said, probably Pokrovsk, has essentially fallen already. There's mopping up to do. There's a few places in the northeast of Pokrovsk still to clear. The defense ministry says that in the industrial area to the northwest of Pokrovsk, there are a few Ukrainian holdouts still. In the western areas, there are reports that the Russians are advancing north of Pokrovsk towards Olimpisky Street. This is a road, actually, that passes through the fields. It's the supply road that leads to the crossroads. If the Russians close that road, then frankly, it's one can say that the cauldron is trebly sealed. But anyway, Pokrovsk is lost. Mirnograd is lost. Zelensky won't accept it. He is saying that if Pokrovsk is lost, then the Russians can advance to the Dnieper, and that would be a disaster for Ukraine. But he is compounding the disaster by throwing more men and more machines into a battle that has already been decided and which has already been lost. This all reminds me very much of what happened in 2023 in the Battle of Bakhmut. It became very clear beyond a certain point that the Ukrainians were going to lose Bakhmut. And Bakhmut, as I pointed out at the time, is indeed a strategically important place in order for the Russians to advance deeper into Donbass, to start to break the Ukrainian defense lines in Donbass. They had to capture Bakhmut, which bound those defense lines together. So undoubtedly, Bakhmut, despite claims to the contrary, was an important strategic position. But it became obvious that Ukraine was going to lose it and that the Ukrainians were suffering inordinately heavy losses seeking to defend it. And the Americans and some Ukrainians and people like myself in independent media, I was not the only one, not by any means, were saying, face the reality. Bakhmut is lost. Withdraw. Save the men. But Zelensky refused. He would not accept that the fortress, the Bakhmut fortress, could be surrendered under any circumstances. He eventually committed something like a third of the Ukrainian army to trying to defend Bakhmut. There was a massive bloodletting in Bakhmut, which severely weakened the Ukrainian army and left it in a far less powerful position to conduct its own offensive, the one that it sought to launch a few weeks later in Zaporozhye region, seeking to break through to the Black Sea and to the Sea of Azov. Zelensky has learned nothing from that debacle, the Bakhmut debacle. He is repeating it all over again in Pokrovsk, though in circumstances today which are much worse for Ukraine than the circumstances were back in the spring of 2023. Anyway, we shall see what happens. As I said, everybody is advising Zelensky to stop. He won't stop. Sirski continues to carry out his orders. Men continue to be sent to die. This battle will presumably continue, though I read a report this morning, this is on a Russian site, that they expect the Russian Defense Ministry to announce that Pokrovsk is fully under Russian control within the next 48 to 72 hours. Well, we'll see if that turns out to be the case. There will still be Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd, but of course the battle there is even more likely to end in a debacle than the one in Pokrovsk already, which already, in my opinion, basically has. Now, all sorts of things are happening in many other places on the battle lines. The Russians look like they've finally got on top of the Ukrainian defences in Uspenivka. That might imply that this is a long battle, but I don't think it was. The Russians will very soon, it seems, be in a position to encircle the city of Guliapolye, which has a much longer history, by the way, than Pokrovsk itself does. And there are reports that the Russians north of Liman continue to push forward through the Sviatigorsk forest towards the town of Sviatigorsk and its famous monastery. And there are further reports that the Russians are continuing to tighten their grip around Siversk and that the fighting there is already underway, and we'll see how long that lasts. The Russians, incidentally, have also officially now contradicted Ukrainian claims that they were pushed back in Yampol. The Russian Defense Ministry says that, on the contrary, Russian forces have continued to improve their tactical situation along the front line, including in the area of Yampol itself. Anyway, I'm not going to spend more time discussing the battles in these other places. As we've seen, the Russian Defense Ministry also claims that the Russians have the situation in Kupiansk fully in hand and that the Ukrainian troops there remain encircled also. Now, I want to just touch on some of the recent political developments in the United States. In a recent program, I mentioned the mayoral election in New York. I've said all that I have to say about that. But it is also the case that there have been elections in other places, in Virginia and New Jersey, and it looks as if the Democrats have done very well in them. There does seem to be now clear signs of a swing back to the Democratic Party in various elections across the United States. This despite the fact that the Democratic Party remains deeply unpopular in the United States, as confirmed by every opinion poll which I have seen. So, what explains this? Well, the US Vice President, J.D. Vance, has now said that what the administration needs to do is to focus more on domestic matters. And he is, of course, absolutely right. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, was elected last November, a year ago, precisely because there was an apparent deterioration in conditions of life for most Americans domestically. And they expected him to address that. Instead, he has spent most of his time, as far as I can see, dealing with issues of foreign policy. He has spent a huge amount of time over Ukraine. Alex Cristoforo and I on the Duran repeatedly said before the election itself that he should just walk away from Ukraine, let the events there take their course, tell the Europeans that it is their problem, tell the Ukrainians that it is their problem, that the United States has already done everything that it can, and that it cannot realistically be expected to do more. Instead, going totally against this thinking, the president threw himself into a completely unworkable diplomatic strategy, trying to persuade the Russians to freeze the conflict as advised by his aide, General Kellogg, despite the fact that the Russians have always and repeatedly said that that is one thing that they will never agree to. And the result is he spent huge amounts of time and effort meeting with the Europeans, meeting with Zelensky. I believe he's spoken on the phone to President Putin of Russia. Some say as many as 8 times. I haven't kept a count. He's had a summit meeting with Putin. He was going to hold another summit meeting with Putin, and then he called it off. People in the towns and cities of the United States for whom life is hard and getting harder are not going to be impressed by all of this. And then, of course, he negotiated a ceasefire in Gaza, which is a good thing, except that that ceasefire is not really a ceasefire, because every other day one reads reports about Israel resuming bombing of Gaza and about violence continuing there. And again, he claimed victory, though that victory clearly is greatly premature. And I just read an article, a very good article, in Responsible Statecraft, which compared President Trump's declaration of victory in Gaza with George W. Bush's infamous mission accomplished performance when he arrived on the US aircraft carrier and there was the mission accomplished banner behind him following the capture of Baghdad. And as we all know, it wasn't a mission accomplished at all. And the president is now deploying huge naval forces in the Caribbean, threatening Venezuela, giving the impression that he's about to attack Venezuela, but unable apparently to make up his mind to do that, though, as I've said already, I think eventually he will. And he's now uttered threats against Nigeria also. I haven't, to be frank, followed that story very closely. And he's had meetings with President Xi Jinping of China, which have not moved the dial on his domestic agenda at all. And he's used tariffs, which were supposed to be part of some protectionist economic policy, basically as an instrument of economic coercion against various countries to get them to make geopolitical concessions to the United States. Only that hasn't worked either. And I understand that the oral arguments in the Supreme Court on the tariff question, which took place yesterday, appeared to go badly against the president, and that most people are now expecting the Supreme Court to rule against him on his tariff policy. Well, we will wait and see. We'll have to wait and see. And then he's threatened sanctions. Well, he's not threatened, he's imposed sanctions against Russian oil companies, and he's attempting to restrict Russia's exports of oil, heedless of the effect that might have on the oil price, which will, of course, affect living standards in the United States as well. And he has the humiliation that comes from the fact that so far China is openly defying him on oil purchases from Russia. As I've said, Xi Jinping and Russian Prime Minister Mishustin have talked about upgrading energy cooperation. And in India, the Prime Minister of India won't meet him, and the Indian National Oil Company has made further purchases of Russian oil for delivery to India in December. So all of this completely cuts across, as far as I can see, the reasons why he was elected. And I'm not going to even touch, I haven't even touched on some of the scandals, his refusal to release documents about the nefarious activities of, shall we call him, a former financier. Is it surprising that he is losing the support of his base, that people are not coming out and voting for him? We've already also had the 12-day war against Iran, which I overlooked. But most of his time, most of his energy over this last year has been devoted to foreign policy. And he's now, as a result of a few loose words about nuclear testing, on the brink of catapulting the United States into a completely unaffordable new arms race with the Russians and ultimately the Chinese too. Now, Vice President Vance is absolutely right when he says that the United States, the administration, needs to concentrate on domestic matters. For reasons that I don't fully understand, it seems to me that the president has allowed himself to be surrounded, or has chosen to be surrounded, by a whole group of people: Radcliffe, Kellogg, Rubio, Waltz, who are ultimately far more interested in pursuing neocon foreign policies than either the economic well-being of the American people or Donald Trump's political well-being. But that comes with a heavy political cost for himself. He says he is absolutely furious about the result of the election in New York, and he talks about the dangers, about his determination to prevent a communist, as he puts it, from ever being elected president of America. I don't believe such a possibility exists. But if he means by that that he doesn't want someone from the left to be elected president of the United States, well, all I will say is that he has been working very hard over the last year to make that happen. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish my program today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. And of course, please don't forget also to check out our new Substack page, the Duran Substack page, for which, by the way, I am in the process of writing another article. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.